west, and south for Hereford. This was proof that he was a civilian bureaucrat, Clark told himself in the lead car. Otherwise, they'd have used helicopters. But Britain wasn't entirely devoid of civilization. They stopped at a roadside McDonald's for Egg McMuffins and coffee. Sandy snorted at the cholesterol intake. She'd been chiding John about it for months. Then she thought about the previous night.
John?
Yes, honey?
Who were they?
Who, the guys on the airplane? He looked over and got a nod. Not sure. Probably Basque separatists. It looked like they were after the Spanish ambassador, but they screwed up big time. He wasn't aboard, just his wife.
They were trying to hijack the airplane?
Yep, they sure were.
Isn't that scary?
John nodded thoughtfully. Yes, it is. Well, would have been scarier if they were competent, but they weren't. An inner smile. Boy, did they ever pick the wrong flight. But he couldn't laugh about it now, not with his wife sitting next to him, on the wrong side of the road, a fact that had him looking up in some irritation. It felt very wrong to be on the left side of the road, driving along at 80 miles per hour? Damn. Didn't they have speed limits here?
What'll happen to them? Sandy persisted.
There's an international treaty. The Canadians will ship them back to the States for trial. Federal court. They'll be tried, convicted, and imprisoned for air piracy. They'll be behind bars for a long time. And they were lucky at that, Clark didn't add. Spain might well have been a little more unpleasant about it.
First time in a long time something like that happened.
Yep, her husband agreed. You had to be a real dolt to hijack airplanes, but dolts, it appeared, were not yet an endangered species. That was why he was the sixth of an organization called Rainbow. There is good news and there is bad news, the memo he'd written had begun. As usual, it wasn't couched in bureaucraties. It was a language Clark had never quite learned, despite his 30 years in CIA. With the demise of the Soviet Union and other nation-states, with political positions adverse to American and Western interests, the likelihood of a major international confrontation is at an all-time low. This, clearly, is the best of good news. But along with that, we must face the fact that there remain many experienced and trained international terrorists still roaming the world, some with lingering contacts with national intelligence agencies, plus the fact that some nations, while not desirous of a direct confrontation with American or other Western nations, could still make use of the remaining terrorist free agents for more narrow political goals. If anything, this problem is very likely to grow, since under the previous world situation, the major nation-states placed firm limits on terrorist activity. These limits enforced by controlled access to weapons, funding, training, and safe havens. It seems likely that the current world situation will invert the previous understanding enjoyed by the major countries. The price of support, weapons, training, and safe havens might well become actual terrorist activity, not the ideological purity previously demanded by sponsoring nation-states. The most obvious solution to this, probably, increasing problem, will be a new multinational counter-terrorist team. I propose the codename Rainbow. I further propose that the organization be based in the United Kingdom. The reasons for this are simple. The UK currently owns and operates the Special Air Service, the world's foremost, that is, most experienced, special operations agency. London is the world's most accessible city in terms of commercial air travel, in addition to which the SAS has a very cordial relationship with British Airways. The legal environment is particularly advantageous due to press restrictions possible under British law but not American. the long-standing special relationship between American and British governmental agencies. For all of these reasons, the proposed Special Operations Team, composed of U.S., U.K., and selected NATO personnel, with full support from National Intelligence Services, coordinated at site. And he'd sold it, Clark told himself with a wispy smile. It had helped that both Ed and Mary Pat Foley had backed him up in the Oval Office, along with General Mickey Moore and selected others. The new agency, Rainbow, was blacker than black. Its American funding directed through the Department of the Interior by Capitol Hill, then through the Pentagon's Office of Special Projects, with no connection whatsoever to the intelligence community. Fewer than 100 people in Washington knew that Rainbow existed. A far smaller number would have been better, but that was about the best that could be expected. The chain of command was a little baroque. No avoiding that. The British influence would be hard to shake. Fully half of the field personnel were Brits, and nearly that many of the intel weenies, but Clark was the boss. That constituted a major concession from his hosts, John knew. Alistair Stanley would be his executive officer, and John didn't have a problem with that. Stanley was tough, and, better yet, one of the smartest special operations guys he'd ever met. He knew when to hold, when to fold, and when to play the cards. About the only bad news was that he, Clark, was now a Remoff. Worse, a suit. He'd have an office and two secretaries instead of going out to run with the big dogs. Well, he had to admit to himself that had to come sooner or later, didn't it? Shit. He wouldn't run with the dogs, but he would play with them. He had to do that, didn't he? To show the troops that he was worthy of his command. He would be a colonel, not a general, Clark told himself. He'd be with the troops as much as possible, running, shooting, and talking things over. Meanwhile, I'm a captain, Ding was telling himself in the next car behind, while eagerly taking in the countryside. He'd only been through Britain for layovers at Heathrow or Gatwick, and never seen the land, which was as green as an Irish postcard. He'd be under John, Mr. C., leading one of the strike teams, and in effective rank, that made him a captain, which was about the best rank to have in the army. High enough that the NCOs respected you as worthy of command, and low enough that you weren't a staff puke and you played with the troops. He saw Patsy was dozing next to him. The pregnancy was taking it out of her, and doing so in unpredictable ways. Sometimes she bubbled with activity. Other times she just vegetated. Well, she was carrying a new little Chavez in her belly, and that made everything okay. Better than okay. A miracle. Almost as great as the miracle that here he was back doing what he'd originally been trained for, to be a soldier. Better yet, something of a free agent. The bad news was that he was subject to more than one government. Suits that spoke multiple languages. But that couldn't be helped. And he'd volunteered for this to stay with Mr. C. Someone had to look after the boss. The airplane had surprised him quite a bit. Mr. C. hadn't had his weapon handy. What the hell, Ding thought. You bother to get a permit that allows you to carry a weapon on a civilian airliner, about the hardest thing you can wish to have, and then you stash your weapon where you can't get at it? Santa Maria! Even John Clark was getting old. Must have been the first operational mistake he'd made in a long time. And then he'd tried to cover it by going cowboy on the takedown. Well, it had been nicely done. Smooth and cool. But overly fast, Ding thought. Overly fast. He held Patsy's hand. She was sleeping a lot now. The little guy was sapping her strength. Ding leaned over to kiss her lightly on the cheek, softly enough that she didn't stir. He caught the driver's eye in the mirror and stared back with a poker expression. Was the guy just a driver or a team member? He'd find out soon enough, Chavez decided. Security was tougher than Ding had expected. For the moment, Rainbow HQ was at Hereford, headquarters of the British Army's 22nd Special Air Service Regiment. In fact, security was even tougher than it looked, because a man holding a weapon just looked like a man holding a weapon. From a distance, you couldn't tell the difference between a rent-a-cop and a trained expert. On eyeballing one close, Ding decided these guys were the latter. They just had different eyes. The man who looked into his car earned himself a thoughtful nod, which was dutifully returned as he waved the car forward. The base looked like any other. The signs were different, as was some of the spelling, but the buildings had closely trimmed lawns, and things just looked neater than in civilian areas. His car ended up in officer country, by a modest but trim house, complete with a parking pad for a car Ding and Patsy didn't have yet. He noticed that John's car kept going another couple of blocks toward a larger house. Well, colonels lived better than captains, and you couldn't beat the rent in any case. Ding opened the door, twisted out of the car, and headed for the trunk. Excuse me, he thought. Boot. To get their luggage moved in. Then came the first big surprise of this day. "Major Chavez?" a voice asked. Yeah, Ding said, turning. "Major," he wondered. "I'm Corporal Weldon. I'm your Batman." The corporal was much taller than Ding's 5'7" and beefy-looking. The man bustled past his assigned officer and manhandled the bags out of the trunk/boot, leaving Chavez with nothing more to do or say than, "Thanks, Corporal." "Follow me, sir." Ding and Patsy did that, too. 300 meters away, it was much the same for John and Sandy, though their staff was a sergeant and a corporal, the latter female, blonde, and pretty in the pale-skinned English way. Sandy's first impression of the kitchen was that British refrigerators were tiny, and that cooking in here would be something of an exercise in contortion. She was a little slow to catch on, a result of the air travel, that she'd touch an implement in this room only at the sufferance of Corporal Ann Fairway. The house wasn't quite as large as their home in Virginia, but would be quite sufficient.
"Where's the local hospital?" "About 6 kilometers away, Mum."
Fairway hadn't been briefed in on the fact that Sandy Clark was a highly trained ER nurse and would be taking a position in the hospital. John checked out his study. The most impressive piece of furniture was the liquor cabinet, well-stocked, he saw, with scotches and gins. He'd have to figure a way to get some decent bourbons. The computer was in place, tempested, he was sure, to make sure that people couldn't park a few hundred yards away and read what he was typing. Of course, getting that close would be a feat. The perimeter guards had struck John as competent. While his Batman and woman got his clothes squared away, John hopped into the shower. This would be a day of work for him. 20 minutes later, wearing a blue pinstripe suit, a white shirt, and a striped tie, he appeared at the front door, where an official car waited to whisk him off to his headquarters building. "Have fun, honey," Sandy said with a kiss.
"You bet."
"Good morning, sir," his driver said. Clark shook his hand and learned that his name was Ivor Rogers, and that he was a sergeant. The bulge at his right hip probably made him an MP. Damn, John thought, the Brits take their security seriously. But then this was the home of the SAS, probably not the most favorite unit of terrorists both inside and outside the UK. And the real professionals, the truly dangerous ones, were careful, thorough people. "Just like me," John Clark told himself.
"We have to be careful, extremely careful, every step of the way."
That was no particular surprise to the others, was it? The good news was that they understood about caution. Most were scientists, and many of them routinely trafficked in dangerous substances, level 3 and up. And so caution was part of their way of looking at the world. And that, he decided, was good. It was also good that they understood, really understood the importance of the task at hand. A holy quest, they all thought, knew it to be. After all, they were dealing in human life, the taking thereof. And there were those who didn't understand their quest and never would. Well, that was to be expected, since it was their lives which would be forfeited. It was too bad, but it couldn't be helped. With that, the meeting broke up, later than usual, and people left, to walk out to the parking lot, where some, fools he thought, would ride bicycles home, catch a few hours of sleep, and then bike back to the office. At least they were true believers, if not overly practical ones. And hell, they rode airplanes for long trips, didn't they? Well, the movement had room for people of differing views. The whole point was to create a big tent movement. He walked out to his own vehicle, a very practical Hummer, the civilian version of the military's beloved Humvee. He flipped on the radio, heard Respighi's The Pines of Rome, and realized that he'd miss NPR and its devotion to classical music. Well, some things couldn't be helped. Showered, shaved, and dressed in a Brooks Brothers suit and an Armani tie purchased 2 days before, Clark walked out of his official residence, toward his official car, the driver standing there to hold the door open. The Brits were really into status symbols, and John wondered how quickly he might become addicted to them. It turned out that his office was less than 2 miles from his house, in a 2-story brick building surrounded by workers. Another soldier was at the front door, a pistol tucked away in a white canvas holster. He snapped to and saluted when Clark got within 10 feet.
"Good morning, sir."
John was sufficiently startled that he returned the salute, as though crossing onto the quarter-deck of a ship. "Morning, soldier," John replied, almost sheepishly, and thinking he'd have to learn the kid's name. The door he managed to open for himself, to find Stanley inside, reading a document and looking up with a smile.
"The building won't be finished for another week or so, John. It was unused for some years, rather old, I'm afraid, and they've only been working on it for 6 weeks. Come, I'll take you to your office."
And again Clark followed, somewhat sheepishly, turning right and heading down the corridor to the end office, which was, it turned out, all finished. "The building dates back to 1947, Alistair said, opening the door. There John saw 2 secretaries, both in their late 30s, and probably cleared higher than he was. Their names were Alice Forgate and Helen Montgomery. They stood when the boss came in, and introduced themselves with warm and charming smiles. Stanley's XO office was adjacent to Clark's, which contained a huge desk, a comfortable chair, and the same kind of computer as in John's CIA office. Tempested here, too, so that people couldn't monitor it electronically. There was even a liquor cabinet in the far-right corner, doubtless a British custom. John took a breath before trying out the swivel chair, and decided to doff his jacket first. Sitting in a chair with a suit coat on was something he'd never really learned to enjoy. That was something a suit did, and being a suit wasn't John's idea of fun. He waved Alistair to the seat opposite the desk. "Where are we?"
"Two teams fully formed. Chavez will have one. The other will be commanded by Peter Covington. Just got his majority. Father was colonel of the 22nd some years ago, retired as a brigadier. Marvelous lad. 10 men per team, as agreed. The technical staff is coming together nicely. We have an Israeli chap on that, David Peled. Surprised they let us have him. He's a bloody genius with electronics and surveillance systems.
And he'll report back to Avi Ben Jacob every day." A smile. "Naturally." Neither office was under any illusions about the ultimate loyalty of the troops assigned to Rainbow. But were they not capable of such loyalty, what good would they be?
David's worked with SAS on and off for a decade. He's quite amazing, contacts with every electronics corporation from San Jose to Taiwan.
And the shooters?
Top drawer, John. As good as any I've ever worked with.
Which was saying something. Intel?
All excellent. The chief of that section is Bill Tawney. A six-man for 30 years, supported by Dr. Paul Bellow. Temple University, Philadelphia, was a professor there until your FBI seconded him. Bloody smart chap. Mind reader. He's been all over the world. Your chaps lent him to the Italians for the Moro job, but he refused to take an assignment to Argentina the next year. Principled also, or so it would seem. He flies in tomorrow.
Just then Mrs. Forgate came in with a tray, tea for Stanley, coffee for Clark.
"Staff meeting starts in 10 minutes, sir," she told John.
"Thanks, Alice." Sir, he thought. Clark wasn't used to being addressed like that. Yet another sign he was a suit. Damn. He waited until the heavy soundproof door closed to ask his next question.
"Al, what's my status here?"
"A general officer. Brigadier, at least. Maybe a two-star. I seem to be a colonel. A chief of staff, you see,"
Stanley said, sipping his tea.
"John, you know there must be protocol," he went on reasonably. "Al, you know what I really am. Was, I mean.
You were a Navy chief bosun's mate, I believe, with the Navy Cross, Silver Star with a repeat cluster, Bronze Star with Combat V and 3 repeats and 3 Purple Hearts. And all that's before the agency took you in and gave you no less than 4 intelligence stars.
Stanley said all this from memory.
"Brigadier's the least we can do, old man. Rescuing Koga and taking Darye out were bloody brilliant jobs, in case I never told you. We do know a little bit about you, and your young Chavez. The lad has enormous potential, if he's as good as I've heard. Of course he'll need it. His team is composed of some real stars."
"Yo, Ding!" a familiar voice called.
Chavez looked to his left in genuine surprise.
"Oso, you son of a bitch! What the hell are you doing here?"
Both men embraced.
"The Rangers were getting boring, so I shipped up to Bragg for a tour with Delta, and then this came up on the scope and I went after it. You're the boss for Team 2?"
First Sergeant, E-8, Julio Vega, asked.
"Sorta, kinda," Ding replied, shaking the hand of an old friend and comrade.
"Ain't lost no weight, man. Jesu Cristo, Oso, you eat barbells?"
"Gotta keep fit, sir," replied a man for whom 100 morning push-ups didn't generate a drop of sweat. His uniform blouse showed a combat infantryman's badge and the silver ice cream cone of a master parachutist.
"You're looking good, man. Keeping up your running, eh?" "Yeah, well, running away is an ability I want to keep, if you know what I mean." "Rajo," Vega laughed. "Come on, I'll intro you to the team. We've got some good troops, Ding." Team 2, Rainbow, had its own building, brick single-story and fairly large, with a desk for every man, and a secretary named Catherine Mooney they'd all share, young and pretty enough, Ding noticed, to attract the interest of any unattached member of his team. Team 2 was composed exclusively of NCOs, mainly senior ones, 4 Americans, 4 Brits, a German, and a Frenchman. He only needed one look to see that all were fit as hell. Enough so that Ding instantly worried about his own condition. He had to lead them, and that meant being as good as, or better than, all of them in every single thing the team would have to do. Sergeant Louis Loisel was the nearest. Short and dark-haired, he was a former member of French parachute forces, and had been detailed to DGSE some years before. Loisel was vanilla, a utility infielder, good in everything but a non-specialist specialist. Like all of the men, a weapons expert, and, his file said, a brilliant marksman with pistol and rifle. He had an easy, relaxed smile and a good deal of confidence behind it. Feldwebel Dieter Weber was next, also a paratrooper and a graduate of the German Army's Bergerführer, or Mountain Leader School, one of the physically toughest schools in any army in the world. He looked it. Blonde-haired and fair-skinned, he might have been on an SS recruiting poster 60 years earlier. His English, Ding learned at once, was better than his own. He could have passed for American, or English. Weber had come to Rainbow from the German GSG-9 team, which was part of the former Border Guards, the Federal Republic's counter-terror team. "Major, we have heard much about you," Weber said from his 6'3 height. A little tall, Ding thought, too large a target. He shook hands like a German. One quick grab, vertical jerk, and let go, with a nice squeeze in the middle. His blue eyes were interesting, cold as ice, interrogating Ding from the first. The eyes were usually found behind a rifle. Weber was one of the team's two long riflemen. Sergeant First Class Homer Johnston was the other. A mountaineer from Idaho, he'd taken his first deer at the age of 9. He and Weber were friendly competitors. Average-looking in all respects, Johnston was clearly a runner rather than an iron pumper at his 6 feet nothing, 160. He'd started off in the 101st Air Mobile at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and rapidly worked his way into the Army's black world. "Major, nice to meet you, sir." He was a former Green Beret and Delta member, like Chavez's friend, Oso Vega. The shooters, as Ding thought of them, the guys who went into the buildings to do business, were Americans and Brits. Steve Lincoln, Paddy Connolly, Scotty McTyler, and Eddie Price were from the SAS. They'd all been there and done that in Northern Ireland and a few other places. Mike Pierce, Hank Patterson, and George Tomlinson mainly had not, because the American Delta Force didn't have the experience of the SAS. It was also true, Ding reminded himself, that Delta, SAS, GSG-9, and other crack international teams cross-trained to the point that they might as well have married one another's sisters. Every one of them was taller than Major Chavez. Everyone was tough. Everyone was smart. And with this realization came an oddly deflating feeling that, despite his own field experience, he'd have to earn the respect of his team and earn it fast. "Who's senior?" "That's me, sir," Eddie Price said. He was the oldest of the team, 41, and a former color sergeant in the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment, since spot promoted to sergeant major. Like the rest in the bullpen, he was wearing non-uniform clothes, though they were all wearing the same non-uniform things, without badges of rank. "Okay, Price, have we done our PT today?" "No, Major, we waited for you to lead us out," Sergeant Major Price replied, with a smile that was 10% manners and 90% challenge. Chavez smiled back. "Yeah, well, I'm a little stiff from the flight, but maybe we can loosen that up for me. Where do I change?" Ding asked, hoping his last 2 weeks of 5-mile daily runs would prove to be enough. And he was slightly wasted by the flight. "Follow me, sir." "My name's Clark, and I suppose I'm the boss here," John said from the head of the conference table. "You all know the mission, and you've all asked to be part of Rainbow. Questions?" That startled them, John saw. "Good." Some continued to stare at him. Most looked down at the scratch pads in front of them. "Okay, to answer some of the obvious ones, our operational doctrine ought to be a little different from the organizations you came from. We will establish that in training, which commences tomorrow. We are supposed to be operational right now," John warned them. "That means the phone could ring in a minute, and we will have to respond. Are we able to?" "No," Alistair Stanley responded for the rest of the senior staff. "That's unrealistic, John. We need, I would estimate, 3 weeks. I understand that. But the real world is not as accommodating as we would like it to be. Things that need doing, do them, and quickly. I will start running simulations on Monday next. People, I am not a hard man to work with. I've been in the field, and I know what happens out there. I don't expect perfection, but I do expect that we will always work for it. If we screw a mission up, that means that people who deserve to live will not live. That is going to happen. You know it, I know it. But we will avoid mistakes as much as possible, and we will learn the proper lessons from everyone we make. Counterterrorism is a Darwinian world. The dumb ones are already dead. And the people out there we have to worry about are those who've learned a lot of lessons. So have we. And we're probably ahead of the game, tactically speaking. But we have to run hard to stay there. We will run hard. Anyway, he went on, intelligence. What's ready and what's not. Bill Tawney was John's age, plus one or two, John estimated, with brown thinning hair and an unlit pipe in his mouth. A six man, meaning he was a former, well, current, member of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, he was a field spook who'd come inside after 10 years working the streets behind the curtain. Our communications links are up and running. We have liaison personnel to all friendly services either here or in the corresponding capitals. How good are they? Fair, Tony allowed. John wondered how much of that was Brit understatement. One of his most important but most subtle tasks would be to decode what every member of his staff said when he or she spoke, a task made all the more difficult by linguistic and cultural differences. On inspection, Tawney looked like a real pro, his brown eyes calm and businesslike. His file said that he'd worked directly with SAS for the past 5 years. Given SAS's record in the field, he hadn't stiffed them with bad intel very often, if at all. Good. David? He asked next. David Peled, the Israeli chief of his technical branch, looked very Catholic, rather like something from an El Greco painting, a Dominican priest, perhaps, from the 15th century, tall, skinny, hollow of cheek and dark of hair, short, with a certain intensity of eye. Well, he'd worked a long time for Avi Ben-Yakob, whom Clark knew. If not well, then well enough. Peled would be here for two reasons, to serve as a senior Rainbow staffer, thus winning allies and prestige for his parent intelligence service, the Israeli Mossad, and also to learn what he could and feed it back to his boss. I am putting together a good staff, David said, setting his tea down. I need 3 to 5 weeks to assemble all the equipment I need. Faster, Clark responded at once. David shook his head. Not possible. Much of our electronics items can be purchased off the shelf, as it were, but some will have to be custom-made. The orders are all placed, he assured his boss, with high-priority flags, from the usual vendors. TRW, IDI, Marconi, you know who they are. But they can't do miracles even for us. 3 to 5 weeks for some crucial items. SAS are willing to hire anything important to us, Stanley assured Clark from his end of the table. For training purposes, Clark asked, annoyed that he hadn't found out the answer to the question already. Perhaps. Ding cut the run off at 3 miles, which they'd done in 20 minutes. Good time, he thought, somewhat winded, until he turned to see his 10 men about as fresh as they'd been at the beginning, one or two with a sly smile for his neighbors at their wimpy new leader. Damn. The run had ended at the weapons range, where targets and arms were ready. Here Chavez had made his own change in his team selection. A long-time Beretta aficionado, he'd decided that his men would use the recent .45 Beretta as their personal sidearms, along with the Heckler & Koch MP-10 submachine gun, the new version of the venerable MP-5, chambered instead for the 10mm Smith & Wesson cartridge developed in the 1980s for the American FBI. Without saying anything, Ding picked up his weapon, donned his ear protectors, and started going for the silhouette targets, set 5 meters away. There he saw all 8 holes in the head. But Dieter Weber, next to him, had grouped his shots in 1 ragged hole. And Paddy Connolly had made what appeared to be 1 not-so-ragged hole less than an inch across, all between the target's eyes, without touching the eyes themselves. Like most American shooters, Chavez had believed that Europeans didn't know pistols worth a damn. Evidently, training corrected that, he saw. Next, people picked up their H&Ks, which just about anyone could shoot well because of the superb diopter sights. Ding walked along the firing line, watching his people engage pop-up steel plates the size and shape of human heads. Driven up by compressed air, they fell back down instantly with a metallic clang. Ding ended up behind First Sergeant Vega, who finished his magazine and turned. "Told you they were good, Ding." "How long they been here?" "Oh, about a week. Used to running 5 miles, sir," Julio added with a smile. "Remember the summer camp we went to in Colorado?" Most important of all, Ding thought, was the steady aim despite the run, which was supposed to get people pumped up and simulate the stress of a real combat situation. But these bastards were as steady as fucking bronze statues. Formerly a squad leader in the 7th Light Infantry Division, he'd once been one of the toughest, fittest, and most effective soldiers in his country's uniform, which was why John Clark had tapped him for a job in the agency. And in that capacity, he'd pulled off some tense and tough missions in the field. It had been a very long time indeed since Domingo Chavez had felt the least bit inadequate about anything. But now quiet voices were speaking into his ear. "Who's the toughest?" he asked Vega. "Weber. I heard stories about the German mountain school. Well, they be true, Mano. Dieter isn't entirely human. Good in hand-to-hand, good pistol, damned good with a rifle. And I think he could run a deer down if he had to, then rip it apart bare-handed." Chavez had to remind himself that being called good in a combat skill by a graduate of Ranger School and Fort Bragg's Special Operations Schools wasn't quite the same as from a guy in a corner bar. Julio was about as tough as they came. "The smartest?" "Connolly. All those SAS guys are tops. Us Americans have to play a little catch-up ball." "But we will," Vega assured him. "Don't sweat it, Ding. You'll keep up with us after a week or so, just like it was in Colorado." Chavez didn't really want to be reminded of that job. Too many friends lost in the mountains of Colombia, doing a job that their country had never acknowledged. Watching his men finish off their training rounds told him much about them. If anyone had missed a single shot, he failed to notice it. Every man fired off exactly 100 rounds, the standard daily regimen for men who fired 500 per working week on routine training, as opposed to more carefully directed drill. That would start tomorrow. "Okay," John concluded. "We'll have a staff meeting every morning at 8:15 for routine matters, and a more formal one every Friday afternoon. My door is always open, including the one at home. People, if you need me, there's a phone next to my shower. Now, I want to get out and see the shooters. Anything else?" "Good. We stand adjourned." Everyone stood and shuffled out the door. Stanley remained. "That went well," Alistair observed, pouring himself another cup of tea. "Especially for one not accustomed to bureaucratic life." "Shows, eh?" Clark asked with a grin. "One can learn anything, John." "I hope so. When's morning PT around here?" 0645. You plan to run and sweat with the lads?
I plan to try, Clark answered.
You're too old, John. Some of those chaps run marathons for recreation. And you're closer to 60 than to 50.
Al, I can't command those people without trying, and you know that.
Quite, Stanley admitted.
They awoke late, one at a time, over a period of about an hour. For the most part, they just lay there in bed, some of them shuffling off to the bathroom, where they also found aspirin and Tylenol for the headaches they all had, along with showers, which half of them decided to take, and the other half to forego. In the adjoining room was a breakfast buffet that surprised them, with pans full of scrambled eggs, pancakes, sausage, and bacon. Some of them even remembered how to use napkins, the people in the monitoring room saw. They met their captor after they'd had a chance to eat breakfast. He offered all of them clean clothes after they got cleaned up.
"What is this place?" asked the one known to the staff only as Number 4. It sure as hell wasn't any Bowery mission he was familiar with.
"My company is undertaking a study," the host said from behind a tightly fitting mask. "You gentlemen will be part of that study. You will be staying with us for a while. During that time you will have clean beds, clean clothes, good food, good medical care, and," he pulled a wall panel back, "whatever you want to drink." In a wall alcove, which the guests remarkably had not yet discovered, were three shelves of every manner of wine, beer, and spirit that could be purchased at the local liquor store, with glasses, water, mixes, and ice.
"You mean we can't leave?" Number 7 asked.
"We would prefer that you stay," the host said, somewhat evasively. He pointed to the liquor cabinet, his eyes smiling around the mask.
"Anyone care for a morning eye-opener?"
It turned out that it wasn't too early in the morning for any of them, and that the expensive bourbons and ryes were the first and hardest hit. The additional drug in the alcohol was quite tasteless, and the guests all headed back to their alcove beds. Next to each was a TV set. Two more decided to make use of the showers. Three even shaved, emerging from the bathroom looking quite human. For the time being. In the monitoring room, half a building away, Dr. Archer manipulated the various TV cameras to get close-ups on every guest.
"They're all pretty much on profile," she observed. "Their blood work ought to be a disaster."
"Oh, yeah, Barb," Dr. Kilgore agreed. "Number 3 looks especially unwell. You suppose we can get him slightly cleaned up before..."
"I think we should try," Barbara Archer, M.D., thought. "We can't monkey with the test criteria too much, can we?"
"Yeah, and it'd be bad for morale if we let one die too soon," Kilgore went on.
"What a piece of work is man," Archer quoted with a snort. "Not all of us, Barb," a chuckle. "Surprised they didn't find a woman or two for the group."
"I'm not," replied the feminist Dr. Archer, to the amusement of the more cynical Kilgore. But it wasn't worth getting all worked up over. He looked away from the battery of TV screens and picked up the memo from corporate headquarters. Their guests were to be treated as guests, fed, cleaned up, and offered all the drink they could put away consistent with the continuance of their bodily functions. It was slightly worrisome to the epidemiologist that all their guest test subjects were seriously impaired street alcoholics. The advantage of using them, of course, was that they wouldn't be missed, even by what might have passed for friends. Few had any family members who would even know where to look for them. Fewer still would have any who would be surprised by the inability to locate them. And none, Kilgore judged, had so much as one who would notify proper authorities on the inability to find them. And even if that happened, would the New York City police care? Not likely.
No, all their guests were people written off by their society. Less aggressively, but just as finally as Hitler had written off his Jews. Though with somewhat more justice, Archer and Kilgore both thought. What a piece of work was man? These examples of the self-designated godlike species were of less use than the laboratory animals they were now replacing. And they were also far less appealing to Archer, who had feelings for rabbits and even rats. Kilgore found that amusing. He didn't much care about them either, at least not as individual animals. It was the species as a whole that mattered, wasn't it? And as far as the guests were concerned, well, they weren't even good examples of the substandard humans whom the species didn't need. Kilgore was. So was Archer, her goofy political sexual views notwithstanding. With that decided, Kilgore returned to making a few notes and doing his paperwork. Tomorrow they'd do the physical examinations. Well, that would be fun, he was sure. Chapter 2. Saddling Up. The first 2 weeks started off pleasantly enough. Chavez was now running 5 miles without any discomfort, doing the requisite number of push-ups with his team, and shooting better, as well as about half of them, but not as well as Connolly and the American Hank Patterson, both of whom must have been born with pistols in their cribs or something. Ding decided after firing 300 rounds per day to try to equal them. Maybe a gunsmith could play with his weapon. The SAS, based here, had a regimental armorer who might have trained with Sam Colt himself, or so he'd heard. A little lighter and smoother on the trigger, perhaps. But that was mere pride talking. Pistols were secondary weapons. With their H&K MP10s, every man could put 3 quick aimed rounds in a head at 50 meters, about as fast as his mind could form the thought. These people were awesome. The best soldiers he'd ever met, or heard about, Ding admitted to himself, sitting at his desk and doing some hated paperwork. He grunted. Was there anyone in the world who didn't hate paperwork? The team spent a surprising amount of time sitting at their desks and reading. Mainly intelligence stuff. Which terrorist was thought to be where, according to some intelligence agency or police department or money-grubbing informer. In fact, the data they pored over was nearly useless, but since it was the best they had, they pored over it anyway as a way of breaking the routine. Included were photos of the world's surviving terrorists. Carlos the Jackal, now in his 50s, and now settled into a French maximum security prison, was the one they'd all wanted. The photos of him were computer-manipulated to simulate his current-age appearance, which they then compared with real-life photos from the French. The team members spent time memorizing all of them, because some dark night in some unknown place, a flash of light might reveal one of these faces. And you'd have that long to decide whether or not to double-tap the head in question. And if you had the chance to bag another Carlos Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, you wanted to take it. 'Cause then, Ding's mind went on, you'd never be able to buy a beer in a cop or special ops bar again anywhere in the world, you'd be so famous. The real hell of it was this pile of trash on his desk wasn't really trash after all. If they ever bagged the next Carlos, it would be because some local cop, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or bumfuck Bosnia, or wherever, heard something from some informant or other, then went to the proper house and took a look, and then had his brain go click from all the flyers that filled cop houses around the world. And then it would be up to the street savvy of that cop to see if he might arrest the bastard on the spot. Or if the situation looked a little too tense, to report back to his lieutenant. And just maybe a special team like Ding's Team 2 would deploy quietly and take the fucker down, the easy way or the hard way, in front of whatever spouse or kids there might be, ignorant of Daddy's former career. And then it would make CNN with quite a splash. That was the problem with working at a desk. He started daydreaming. Chavez, simulated Major, checked his watch and rose, headed out into the bullpen, and handed off his pile of trash to Miss Mooney. He was about to ask if everyone was ready, but they must have been, because the only other person to ask was halfway to the door. On the way, he drew his pistol and belt. The next stop was what the Brits called a robing room, except there were no robes, but instead coal-black fatigue clothes, complete with body armor. Team 2 was all there, mostly dressed a few minutes early for the day's exercise. They were all loose, relaxed, smiling, and joking quietly. When all had their gear on, they went to the arms room to draw their SMGs. Each put the double-looped sling over his head, then checked to see that the magazine was full, sliding each into the proper port on the bottom of the weapon, and working the bolt back to the safe position, then snugging the weapon to make sure that each fitted to the differing specifications of each individual shooter. The exercises had been endless, or as much so as 2 weeks could make them. There were 6 basic scenarios, all of which could be played out in various environments. The one they hated most was inside the body of a commercial aircraft. The only good thing about that was the confinement forced on the bad guys. They wouldn't be going anywhere. The rest was entirely bad. Lots of civilians in the fire arcs, good concealment for the bad guys. And if one of them really did have a bomb strapped to his body, they almost always claimed to, well, then all he had to have was the balls to pull the string or close the switch. And then, if the bastard was halfway competent, everyone aboard was toast. Fortunately, few people chose death in that way. But Ding and his people couldn't think like that. Much of the time, terrorists seemed to fear capture more than death. So your shooting had to be fast and perfect. And the team had to hit the aircraft like a Kansas tornado at midnight, with your flashbangs especially important to stun the bastards into combat ineffectiveness, so that the double taps were aimed at non-moving heads. And hope to God that the civilians you were trying to rescue didn't stand up and block the shooting range that the fuselage of the Boeing or Airbus had suddenly become. Team 2, we ready? Chavez asked.
Yes, sir, came the chorused reply.
With that, Ding led them outside and ran them half a mile to the shooting house. A hard run, not the fast jog of daily exercises. Johnston and Weber were already on the scene, on opposing corners of the rectangular structure.
Command to Rifle 2-2, Ding said into his helmet-mounted microphone. Anything to report?
Negative 2-6, nothing at all, Weber reported.
Rifle 2-1?
6, Johnston replied. I saw a curtain move, but nothing else. Instruments show 4 to 6 voices inside, speaking English. Nothing else to report.
Roger, Ding responded. The remainder of his team concealed behind a truck. He took a final look at the layout of the inside of the building. The raid had been fully briefed. The shooters knew the inside of the structure well enough to see it with their eyes closed. With that knowledge, Ding waved for the team to move. Paddy Connolly took the lead, racing to the door. Just as he got there, he let go of his H&K and let it dangle on the sling while he pulled the primacord from the fanny pack hanging down from his body armor. He stuck the explosive to the door frame by its adhesive and pushed the blasting cap into the top right corner. A second later, he moved right 10 feet. Holding the detonator control up in his left hand, while his right grabbed the pistol grip of his SMG and brought it up to point at the sky. Okay, Ding thought, time to move.
Let's go, he shouted at the team.
As the first of them bolted around the truck, Connolly thumbed the switch, and the door frame disintegrated, sending the door flying inward. The first shooter, Sergeant Mike Pierce, was less than a second behind it, disappearing into the smoking hole with Chavez right behind him. The inside was dark, the only light coming through the shattered doorway. Pierce scanned the room, found it empty, and then lodged himself by the doorway in the next room. Ding ran into that first, leading his team. They were there, four targets and four hostages. Chavez brought his MP-10 up and fired two silenced rounds into the leftmost target's head. He saw the rounds hit, dead center in the head, right between the blue-painted eyes, then traversed right to see that Steve Lincoln had gotten his man just as planned. In less than a second, the overhead lights came on. It was all over. Elapsed time from the Primacord explosion, 7 seconds. 8 seconds had been programmed for the exercise. Ding safed his weapon. "God damn it, John," he said to the Rainbow Commander. Clark stood, smiling at the target to his left, less than 2 feet away. The two holes drilled well enough to ensure certain instant death. He wasn't wearing any protective gear. Neither was Stanley, at the far end of the line, also trying to show off, though Mrs. Forgate and Mrs. Montgomery were, in their center seats. The presence of the women surprised Chavez until he reminded himself that they were team members too, and probably eager to show that they too belonged with the boys. He had to admire their spirit, if not their good sense. 7 seconds. "That'll do, I guess." 5 would be better, John observed. But the dimensions of the building pretty much determined the speed with which the team could cover the distance. He walked across, checking all the targets. McTyler's target showed one hole only, though its irregular shape proved that he'd fired both rounds as per the exercise parameters. Any one of these men would have earned a secure place in 3rd SOG, and every one was as good as he'd ever been, John Clark thought to himself. Well, training methods had improved markedly since his time in Vietnam, hadn't they? He helped Helen Montgomery to her feet. She seemed just a little shaky. Hardly a surprise. Being on the receiving end of bullets wasn't exactly what secretaries were paid for. "You okay?" John asked.
"Oh, quite, thank you. It was rather exciting. My first time, you see."
"My third," Alice Forgate said, rising herself. "It's always exciting," she added with a smile. "For me, too," Clark thought. Confident as he'd been with Ding and his men, still looking down the barrel of a light machine gun and seeing the flashes made one's blood turn slightly cool. And the lack of body armor wasn't all that smart, though he justified it by telling himself he'd had to see better in order to watch for any mistakes. He'd seen nothing major, however. They were damned good. "Excellent," Stanley said from his end of the dais. He pointed. "You, Patterson, sir," the sergeant said. "I know, I kinda tripped coming through." He turned to see that a fragment of the doorframe had been blasted through the entrance to the shooting room, and he'd almost stumbled on it. "You recovered nicely, Sergeant Patterson. I see it didn't affect your aim at all." "No, sir," Hank Patterson agreed, not quite smiling. The team leader walked up to Clark, safing his weapon on the way. "Mark us down fully mission capable, Mr. C," Chavez said with a confident smile. "Tell the bad guys they better watch their asses. How'd Team One do?" 2/10 of a second faster, John replied, glad to see the diminutive leader of two deflate a little. "And thanks."
"What for?"
"For not wasting your father-in-law." John clapped him on the shoulder and walked out of the room. "Okay, people," Ding said to his team, "let's police up the brass and head back for the critique." No fewer than 6 TV cameras had recorded the mission. Stanley would be going over it frame by frame. That would be followed by a few pints at the 22nd's Regimental NCO Club. The Brits, Ding had learned over the previous 2 weeks, took their beer seriously, and Scotty McTyler could throw darts about as well as Homer Johnston could shoot a rifle.
It was something of a breach of protocol that Ding, a simulated major, hoisted pints with his men, all sergeants. He had explained